Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Joining me on the show today is return guest, Professor Cal Newport. Cal Newport is a professor of computer science at Georgetown University, where he's also a founding member of the Center for Digital Ethics. He was actually in Austin this weekend, so I was super pumped to record in person with him about his new book, Slow Productivity, The Lost Art of Accomplishment Without Burnout. The book is focused on Cal's critique of so much of our working lives being dedicated to pseudo-productivity, a problem that's only increased with the prevalence of digital tools and the post-pandemic work normal. What's great about Cal, though, is he is not only talking about the self-help topics one could see in any airport book, but he also has deeper thoughts on everything from technology to the way we work that really fits into the themes of his writing in The New Yorker. We also talk about the creator economy and his thoughts on the Apple Vision Pro and the future of spatial computing. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. And you could, of course, find a link to his book in the Realignment's show notes. A huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Cal Newport, welcome back to The Realignment.
Yes, in person for the first time, which I appreciate. Yes.
We had a very Zoom era post-pandemic 2021 recording, so I'm excited to actually do this in person with you. So here is what I want to do. Let's start with identifying the enemy, the opposition, what a lot of folks are going to be thinking about as like their opponent in the context of this conversation. Is this an anti-hustle culture book, or is this an anti-broken productivity theory book? Because as I was reading the book, I was realizing these are actually two different phenomenon.
Yes.
And it's important to identify which one we're focused on.
Yeah, I'm focused on broken productivity. And in fact, I think hustle culture as a phenomenon is a very online phenomenon. I think we exaggerate the idea that there's just this culturally instituted pursuit of trying to do more. The reality I get, I work a lot with actual knowledge workers and trying to understand the space. I mean, it was a big part of my beat at The New Yorker for a while. The reality of the space is not a lot of people who are watching Instagram videos about you got to get after it. That's not what is burning people out. It's a broken definition of productivity. So it's a more systemic, technocultural, economic system issue. We had a faulty definition of productivity that we were implicitly implementing. New technology entered the scene. And I'm a techno critic, so I'm always looking for how technology impacts these systems. And we had an unpredictable consequence starting the early 2000s, which is this spiral in knowledge work towards burnout. I think it's entirely this more complicated narrative of how we define productivity, what tools we have, coming together in a way that we didn't anticipate. That is the force, I think, that's driving knowledge workers to be more and more exhausted.
So this is a conversation where definitions really, really matter. I'd like you to define productivity with the note that as you survey in the book, everyone has their own different answer to what productivity means. But from your perspective, what should we understand productivity to
be? Yeah, I mean, most people think they know what it means, but they don't. Right. When I interviewed my readers, okay, what does productivity mean? Most of them, very confidently, but most of them, their answer was just a description of their job, right? It was like to produce, you know, reports on DevOps, on blah, blah. They were just describing their job. And I think this is really the issue, is that we don't have a good explicit definition. So the working definitions, my argument in the first part of the book, our working definition for productivity has been actually what I call pseudo-productivity, which is why don't we use visible activity as a proxy for useful effort. So I see you doing something is better than not seeing you do something. I argue this is what arose in the mid-20th century when knowledge work first became a major economic force in the US context. We quickly realized, and by we, I mean the actual management theorists who were sort of midwifing the birth of this new sector, like trying to explain to the business community, this thing is different than what GM is doing. And here's how we have to try it different. So I'm thinking like Peter Drucker, for example, who coined the term knowledge work. They're trying to figure out how is this thing different? And they realized, okay, we can't use the standard definitions of productivity that had dominated since Adam Smith began isolating this concept in the 18th century, because the standard definitions are quantitative. They look at output per unit input. There's usually a very well-defined system mediating the two. And we can get really specific about it. So I'm building Model Ts. Mm-hmm. I can measure Model Ts produced per labor hour input, right? And when I change how I build Model Ts from the Kraft method to the continuous motion assembly line, that number gets 10 times better. I'm like, okay, this is more productive, right? Same thing with agriculture. I'm planting crops this way. We're getting this many bushels per acre. We switch to the Norfolk 4 crop rotation system. The number goes up. This is a more productive way to plant crops. Knowledge work, none of this works, right? Because there is no bushels of corn or Model Ts that we can count on the way out. Individual knowledge workers are working on multiple things. That's a dynamic, usually, allocation of work. What I'm doing could be different than what you're doing. What I'm doing now is going to be different than what I'm working on a few months from now. And there's no centrally defined systems to even evaluate. All organizational techniques are left to the individual to figure out on their own. So in this context, productivity as a concept completely fell apart. Mm-hmm. We couldn't use the same concept that made the industrial sector be the engine of the whole modern world, essentially, right? This sort of economic miracle. So pseudo-productivity was the fallback. Well, at the very least, let's just, you know, I want to see you're here.
Yep. Time and seat.
I want to see you're doing things, right? This was okay, right? It's not a great metric, but it was okay in a time of, I have to get to this office and we're just going to sit in this office anyways.
You gave a Don Draper example, madman. Yeah. You're in the office.
In the office. Yeah. Yeah. All right. And I want to look, you know, and I want to maybe not be too showy about like the third martini I'm having, right? But then, all right, this is the technocritic angle. We get to the early 2000s. We have the front office IT revolution. Now, with email, networks, and mobile computing, laptops, at any moment, I can demonstrate visible activity. The pace and the granularity of this visible activity just got much smaller because now it's not just I see you in your office, it's individual emails. Right? Mm-hmm. By doing emails and then later on Slack, I'm leaving a digital trace of activity, which pseudo-productivity is going to reward. And because of mobile computing, I can do this anywhere. There's always work to be working on. My conjecture is as we shifted to that new world, pseudo-productivity became increasingly unsustainable.
And this is where this gets interesting because you kind of categorize this book as being a part of the second generation of responses to this issue. What was like the first generations of response? I've had Annie Howen Pearson on this podcast before. I've thought about like the burnout topic. Like what was like the way the first generation of writers and books got at this burnout phenomenon?
Yeah. Well, so even before we get to people putting their finger on it specifically, you can actually see in the productivity literature this interesting shift, the kind of warning shot shift. This is not in the book, but I wrote a New Yorker article recently where I sort of went through the history of business productivity literature starting in the 50s, like all the way up to today. And you see this shift in the 2000s, right? So the 80s and the 90s, this is dominated by Stephen Covey. Mm-hmm. Right? 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, First Things First. These are very optimistic business productivity books. People don't know them today, but these were huge sellers back then.
What's optimistic about them?
You would start, like in Stephen Covey's world, you start by defining like, these are my roles in life, right? Not even just work, outside of work too, right? And I'm going to self-actualize these rules by having like an optimal schedule and choice of activities. And he has these very complicated systems for like my
that's so goal. Alien. I'm just like even thinking.
Think about it. It was incredibly positive, right?
Yeah.
First things first is about the things that matter. And you're going to, and so he had these quad systems, like this very intricate system for you building the ideal schedule every day that made sure that you were making progress on all the things that matter to you in your life. It was like 80s, 90s, rah-rah self-actualization. Yeah. All right. Biggest book of the early 2000s in this literature, David Allen's Getting Things Done. Entirely different tone. David Allen Getting Things Done is we are drowning. Forget self-actualization. Our only goal
zooming in
is to find these moments of Zen peace. That's the goal of Getting Things Done, is to achieve a state called mind like water, where all of these incoming tasks and can just sort of roll over you and not stress you out. It says stress-free productivity. The art of stress-free productivity is the subtitle. Now we're just trying to fight back the mental fatigue of work. It's completely different tone. So what happened between First Things First and Getting Things Done? It's email, right? So you can pick that up in the productivity literature very early on. What are the biggest selling business productivity books of the 2010s? It's my own book, Deep Work, McEwen's book, Essentialism, Gary Keller's book, One Thing. All of these are books about fighting back workload, mm-hmm. like trying to like, how do we fight back overloads? You see it in the literature. And then we get to what you're talking about, like Anne, which is starting around 2018, 2019, you get the anti-productivity movement arises. And that's sort of the first generation of people explicitly addressing there's a real problem here. And so that's the first generation that I'm now going to be the second generation. We get into why in a second, but we get by 2018, 2019, really Ginny O'Dell's book, How to Do Nothing was probably the kickoff of this, in a major way. That book had a really big impact. Obama selected it for like one of his favorite books of the year. Mm-hmm. That's the rise of the first explicit response to this in the knowledge work world is the anti-productivity movement.
I want to take a quick step back because this is fascinating. Because even when you're describing the burning out and the workload, I'm going to take a guess here and guess that it's not actually that we're getting that much more done beyond the obvious that comes via, okay, instead of sending a memo to my boss, I could send 5 emails. But in terms of like, what are the actual outputs of this business? What are the actual outputs that we're trying to produce? What are the services for clients you're producing? I would actually wager that the difference between the 80s and 90s and then the 2010s isn't actually that big. Is that crazy?
No, that's true, right? I mean, you can actually look at just the labor statistics, right? So you can isolate, they'll call it non-industrial productivity. So we can break out industrial productivity, we can break out agricultural productivity. What's left captures knowledge work and some other stuff, but like captures knowledge work, right? It's a big chunk of it. You can just look at the statistics. There's formal measures of productivity, which is just, you know, GDP produced per employees in the sector. That all stagnates starting in the early 2000s. So that number has been stagnant. It's a big puzzle that economists had looked at. Now, it's a messy number because other things happen too, like the Great Recession and other sort of things. But we certainly don't see, with the rise of these essentially like miracles of communication technologies, especially the smartphone, like the ability to anywhere in the world have ubiquitous access to high-speed internet and a supercomputer, you would think, oh my God, and Google, all of this stuff, we're going to see like a big jump in productivity. No, it's been stagnant. Right. And I think this is what's going on. We're not getting more done. And here's why. I mean, here's my actual prescription of what happens. Right. So pseudo productivity says activity is what matters. Digital technology means it's never been easier to like ask someone to do something or to show you're working on something. In this context, if someone says, hey, can you work on this, Marshall? You're really biased towards saying yes, because, again, a visible activity is what measures your productivity. What could be a more scary warning sign than you turning down work, right? So people's workloads got bigger. Now, this wouldn't be a problem if we were like computer processors, where like it doesn't matter. Like every opcode is an opcode. So you might as well have a big queue of stuff so that like you always have something to do. But the problem with modern knowledge work is that everything you say yes to brings with it an administrative overhead. I have to send emails about that thing I said yes to. I have to attend meetings about this thing I said yes to. So as our workloads, the things we said yes to, got more expansive, the fraction of our time spent talking about work as opposed to doing work got much, much larger. So I actually think it's been a productivity rut if we're going to think about just output. Mm-hmm. Because in a pseudo-productivity world, we have too much on our plate, which means we spend more and more of our times talking about work instead of actually accomplishing it. So we're busier than we've ever been before. But the actual rate at which the proverbial Model Ts are coming off the knowledge assembly line, that is much less than it probably would have been in the 80s or 90s.
Could you define knowledge work real quick? Because I think it's actually really important. Because this isn't white collar, blue collar. Like knowledge work is something a little more specific.
It is specific, yeah. And it's also really specific to talk about my critiques of work culture. It's very specific to the dynamics of knowledge work, right? So this does not generalize to the service sector. This does not generalize to industrial work. And so it's very specific to the dynamics of the sector. There's a formal way of defining it in terms of you primarily are adding value to information using your brain. Mm-hmm. The informal way of talking about it is if you spend a lot of time on a computer screen and think you have too much email, you're probably a knowledge worker.
That's a good like 0 or 1 answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's things at the border, like a doctor, mm-hmm. you know, and there's a lot of things at the border, but all these dynamics are really, the reason why they're knowledge work specific is that a defining feature of knowledge work is a huge amount of autonomy and lack of specification. So the feature of it is it's not up to us as the organization to talk about how you should organize your work, how you should collaborate with people, how you should manage your workload. That's up to the individual. That's a defining feature of knowledge work. It's actually Peter Drucker himself was the person who really pushed this autonomy and work management. And that's very different than, say, the service sector, the industrial sector, or certain really highly skilled sectors, which might be cognitive, but it's very structured. Like I'm seeing patients on this particular schedule. There's a huge amount of autonomy in knowledge work, which is what allows these really sort of pathological ways of organizing effort to persist, because there is no one minding the shop and saying, hey, COO, how are we organizing our work? This looks really bad. There is no one. That's the key feature of knowledge work that makes a lot of these issues possible.
And before we get to slow productivity, I have one bigger question for you. It's really interesting if you read a lot of like industrial theory in the 20th century, because sort of the idea, like John Kenneth Galbraith, was we'd be working less because things are more efficient. Side of the productivity rate, things are just more efficient. We could have these 4-hour weeks, these 3-hour, not 4-hour weeks, that's confusing Tim Ferriss, these four-day work weeks instead of like the 5, the 6, the 7. And I kind of find myself in this trap sometimes where I'll just not be working on Friday and I'll feel like, oh man, like look at you, like you're being so lazy. But actually some weeks I produce like 5 podcasts in a week. And that's because I don't need a transcriber because I use like a transcribing AI tool. I could use Zoom, so I don't need to like travel to DC to visit you, even though we're doing this in person. That I'm glad that worked out. But we just have such a, I think there's a weird social construction debate about how much like we should be working relative to our actual productivity. Yeah. I'd love you to like give your thoughts on that.
Well, I think pseudo productivity, once that became standard, spread into the culture. Right. So I think the cultural construct, especially within the independent creatives or freelancers or solopreneur knowledge workers, who in theory you have full flexibility. Mm-hmm. Right. And as you're talking about, like you don't have to work on Fridays because technology, like Galbraith predicted, makes things a lot easier. Like you can have a transcriber. You don't have to have you can rent it. Also, just economic efficiencies. A lot of people podcast in Austin.
Yeah.
So now you don't have to have a staff to maintain like your own, you know, studio all the time, et cetera. But we have internalized pseudo productivity. So if that's the main thing we've had in knowledge work, activity is productive. Non-activity is non-productive. It's very difficult not to be active. Right.
Yeah,
and then that pressure comes in. And this is where we get an overlap with hustle culture.
Okay.
Right. Because there's the performative hustle culture that's online, but a lot of that is just algorithm chasing. Right. There's a thread there where, okay, I'm going to study for 12 hours straight and I'm going to live stream it because the algorithm likes that. And I get, you know, good views. And I think that's the thing that's being exaggerated. Maybe young people are plugging into this more than other people, but it's performative, it's online algorithm stuff. But then there's the sort of internalization of activity versus non-activity. And I think that is an impact of pseudo productivity being the only game in town.
Okay. So here's that. I keep saying last question, but this is an actual last question here. How do you perceive, and I mean, you personally, how do you perceive what's online versus real as someone who's not on social media? So you're saying, oh, like hustle culture, that's just like online. Yeah. Another narrative about millennials and Gen Zs in work were those videos of like, hey, I'm a product manager at Meta and I only work like 4 hours because it's this like vibey chill place. Yeah. You could use that as a critique of how knowledge workers actually look. But once again, that's just online.
Yeah.
How do you personally sort through what in these work categories is real and what's fake as someone who's also not scrolling the feed all day?
Well, so I don't engage with that world a lot. So it's really interesting because then I'll run into people that are more online and they'll have a completely different understanding of what's going on. But, you know, a lot of the people I'll be working with or talking to also aren't online. Mm. You know, like most millennial knowledge workers probably aren't spending a lot of time watching these TikToks of the product managers, right? That's more of a narrow niche going on. So what I say often resonates more with them. But I noticed like the anti-productivity crowd, for example, is more online than the average person. So this is like a, not a frustration, but a critique I sometimes have of the anti-productivity crowd is they're often doing battle with this digital chimera that like is not necessarily that impactful on most people who like work at an office or at a computer for their day. It's not that relevant to them, right? So I think hopefully it's an advantage for me that I'm not very online. So I can try to stay more, because when I'm ingrained in the real world of just people and their jobs, it's not extreme in the same way, right? There's not as clear villains either. It's much more just the system is built around pseudo productivity. It's, you know, they're not trying to get after it and I'm going to conquer. They're just trying to do their job.
Yeah.
And they just feel like their job, what is it about this that is becoming kind of deranging to me? You know, it's more subtle, more insidious in some ways.
Okay, so slow productivity, second generation, like what's your response?
Yeah, so I say, here's what we really need to do here. Once we understand the problem, we need a solution that is going to preserve producing stuff you're proud of, work you like doing, work that's successful, like you can support yourself and your family off of it, you can keep your job, preserves that, and then also avoids burnout and also avoids work increasingly annexing more of your life.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the anti-productivity crowd has the second part for sure, but is less interested in the first part,
And in many ways, it's actually anti-work. Extreme online versions are actually anti-work.
It does. It borrows a lot of ideas. I mean, it's a whole interesting political moment because though I would say the anti-productivity movement is definitely more associated with like the progressive left, it's also more associated with a sort of earlier 20th century left-wing labor politics, which itself is sort of at odds with more of the identity-based progressive left thinking of today. Mm-hmm. So you see the anti-productivity movement going back to much more of like a traditional Marxist critique, right? Yeah. That this is late stage capitalism. There's a standard zero sum relationship between owners of capital and the employees being exploited, and like this is so an anti-work response is like a standard early 20th century industrial labor politics play is because in a factory this is zero sum.
Yeah.
Like if I work longer hours, it is better for you, the owner of the factory. Right. If I get paid less, it's better for you, the owner of the factory. So now we're zero sum. So we're going to collectively bind together and we're going to kind of fight this out and try to pull back from you some of the value to keep it for us. The thing with knowledge work is it's messier than that. Mm-hmm. Right. So like this way that we work, this always doing emails, et cetera, it's a really ineffective way to produce value, right? It's not so much a manager or an owner of a company thinking we're going to make so much more money if we do 150 emails a day. Actually, getting rid of email altogether, you're going to probably be much more productive. It's we're more trapped in this suboptimal Nash equilibrium that no one can get out of, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a more complicated picture. So just a pure anti-work response, I don't think is going to be effective here. Also, people like doing stuff that's good and people, you know, have aspirations and they have ambitions. So it's how do we figure out how to preserve that?
Yeah.
Without the burnout. And so slow productivity is the answer to that question.
And it's funny, in some ways, the more ambitious you are, the bigger this is going to be an issue for you. Like the burnout, the feeling of a lack of accomplishment. I think there's a lot of folks who clearly struggle with their transition out of college.
Yes.
High achiever types.
Yes.
Go from assignment, attend this class, do this group project. It's very, there's all sorts of like make work in college and high school and whatever, but like it's still very straightforward.
Yeah.
And the lack of that just becomes not existentially depressing, but there's just like really, that's burnout. Burnout's like the real phenomenon there.
That's what's happening, yeah.
Okay, so then there are basically like there are three rules for slow productivity. Yeah. Let's get into that.
Yeah, no, I call them principles. Yeah, yeah. I think it's fair enough, right? So the three principles are, to summarize, do fewer things, work at more of a natural pace, and then obsess over the quality of what you do. That's my alternative approach to thinking about productivity that I argue is way more sustainable.
Okay, so let's go number one. What does that mean?
Yeah, so do fewer things. It really means do fewer things at once. So this gets back to that issue we were talking about of how many things have you agreed to be actively working on? And if that number gets too high, we begin to get that death spiral where more and more of your time is talking about work. So you fall farther behind and more things begin to pile on. And then even more of your day becomes meetings and emails. That's the single most potent source of derangement in modern knowledge work is that sense of I have no time to work and I'm just talking about work all day. This can't be right. This can't be the right thing. Mm-hmm. Me being in meetings all day long can't possibly be right. I'm like highly trained. I know how to do things. I should be writing these reports or producing these research papers. This can't be the right thing to do. It seems absurd, yet no one's talking about it. So doing fewer things at once, like that has to be the first step. Workload taming, workload management is critical, I think, for getting away from the current burnout.
I guess what's interesting there is I feel like both of our careers are perfectly set up to focus on that one because A, you know, I work on, you know, not deriving self-esteem from overwork. And my version of that was I was doing four episodes a week.
Yeah.
Because I could do four episodes a week. I'm like, look at me, I could do four episodes
That's
a
crazy.
Week.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Like these losers of the New York Times are doing one a week. I could do it. I could do it for basically like 3 months.
Yeah.
But it's a better example of saying, no. Dial it back.
Yes.
Ask yourself, are you doing this because your listeners are asking for this or is this your ego? Yeah. And then dial back. But that's an example of where content creation is actually much more like that Model T production ratio where it's like episodes per week, 60 minutes an episode. It's easy to dial back accordingly. Your example too, like in the academic world, it's like, okay, fewer speaking engagements, fewer yeses to maybe I only do podcast tours during my book tour, not just if I emailed you randomly in like December during like finals grading. But no, this just isn't my period when you do it. So our careers are just very centered around ways that could easily do the fewer part. How do you advise just like your median, like typical, your listener in knowledge work think through this? Because in that case, it's their boss, if it's all BS, because it kind of always BS to a certain degree, how do you actually adjudicate?
Yeah. So two ideas that help. One, you need to make your workload more transparent to other people.
Ah.
Right. So it's one of the big issues in just a standard knowledge work situation is it's all a black box, right? Like, you're just a person that I send things to. In fact, I imagine you as this empty vessel that exists to execute things for me to make my life easier. Right?
Yeah.
And as long as it's just black box, I imagine you as just sitting there like waiting to make my life easier. I give you something. I'm like, why won't you just do this?
Yeah.
Right. Make your workload transparent. These conversations become much more grounded and they become much more realistic. And then the other thing I would suggest is having a clear distinction between working on and queued up for me to work on, right? So let me put both of those together in one concrete suggestion, right? Imagine actually having a shared document. And at the top of that document, these are the projects I'm working on actively right now. There's like three of them or something, right? Then a big dividing line. All right, here are the things that I've queued up to work on next. I've agreed to do in the order in which they're going to jump up into my active, you know, project list as soon as the space clears. Now, when someone comes to you and says, hey, can you do this or what have you? And say it's something you kind of need to say yes to. You can say, yeah, just throw it on that document. Mm-hmm. Just throw it on the queue, right? Now they see very clearly, oh, here's what you're working on. And then here's what you have also to work on. And here's where this is on the queue. And so they might say in this case, actually, never mind, because I actually see the load. Or they say, okay, fine. But now they have a realistic expectation. Oh, it might be a while till you get to it. And because you have this clear distinction between actively working on, waiting to work on, this stuff, even though you said yes to, is not generating administrative overhead. Because it's in the waiting to work on. So now if they want to check in, hey, what about that thing I asked you to do? They could just look at this document and see it marching up the list towards the active project. And it's not until it crosses that dividing line that it's like, now we can like email about and have meetings about it or whatever. So you've also kept the overhead tax that accumulates here low and meaningful. Finally, if a boss in this circumstance is saying this needs to be more of a priority, they are now involved in helping to figure out what to deprioritize.
Yeah.
Like, great. Then let's knock this
trade-offs.
Thing.
There's yeah. clear trade-off.
And now the boss, let's take this thing off. I'll put this on someone else's plate, or let's just delay on this because I think this should be a priority. Now there's a dozen different ways to do this just logistically. If you don't want to just have this shared doc, there's all sorts of different ways I get into. But I think that thought experiment is like the clearest example of this is not you drastically saying no to everything. This is not you saying, I don't do work. It's clarity in workload management, transparency in workload management, division between active and waiting, right? It's kind of in the weeds, makes a huge difference.
I also like that because you're giving the burnt out person a sense of agency in that, okay, you've got this boss who's just as much of a black box from your perspective as they are to you. Yes. And you just have to deal with the stuff. You're saying no. Like, what's likely true, and I know a bunch of listeners had this go through their minds, of a frustrated boss from like, oh yeah, my boss actually totally doesn't know what I'm doing.
Yep.
Especially in a 4-1-3-2 remote work, like mixed degree thing.
Yes.
So like, it's just so helpful to give people a degree of like, no, like there's actually this thing that you're actually probably not doing.
Yes.
That you need to think about doing before you despair or assume your situation can't be improved. So let's go into number two then.
Yeah. Okay. So then we get to work at a natural pace, right? There's a couple elements to it, but one of the big elements to it is the idea that humans can work full intensity, 8 hours a day, just day after day, all year round, is entirely unnatural, right? So you go back and look at the whole history of work, and I did this literally the whole history, right? Like trying to understand what was work for 250,000 years in the Paleolithic. How did that change after the Neolithic revolution, right? Let's actually like look at what work was for humans. So like sort of productive activity, economic activity, even if it's just foraging, right, or hunting. And it's incredibly variable on all sorts of different timescales. Very intense for a couple hours, 3 hours during the heat of the midday sun, just sort of waiting before we continue the hunt. The fall is incredibly busy because we're trying to get this harvest out. But in the winter, we have like nothing to do. So we have to invent, you know, pagan ritual. So we have like, so we're not bored with the ancient Germanics invent Yule, and we're going to have bonfires and like make the barrier between the living and the dead. Like we need something to do, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very variable. Then mills and factories come along. And for the first time in human history, they say, you know what's going to be best for the mills and factory owners is actually like just the more this thing operates, the better. So can you just work all day? There are no seasons. Why would we vary the intensity? This was so unnatural and intolerable that we eventually had to create labor unions. We eventually had to create whole regulatory frameworks to try to like tame the artificialness of this way of working and make it sort of survivable. Mm-hmm. The knowledge work comes along. Like, okay, so how do we want to approach knowledge work? We're like, oh, let's do the factory thing. So we took this like very recent.
And the key thing, the knowledge work doesn't have, you're not breaking, there's no physical limit.
Yes.
As in like no one is like losing their eyesight or ability to weave because they're in a coal mine or because they're like, I mean, there's carpal tunnel to make the joke from The Office, but like, you know, like there's no like, okay, like I'm broken from like spending my time on a keyboard. There's just no actual, because it's all in your head.
Yes. But if you're doing actual interesting cognitive work, you can't do it all day long.
Yeah.
Right. So it's actually a bad way of organizing any sort of interesting cognitive work, which is all that is the prime. I mean, the economic definition of knowledge work is adding new value to information using your brain. Right. That's the fundamental alchemy, the economic alchemy in knowledge work. The brain can't sit there and add value to information 8 hours a day. Right. If you go back, like in the book I study, I call them traditional knowledge workers, mm-hmm. people who do this outside of the offices and modern knowledge work. How did people who had huge flexibility to figure out how they wanted to work and use their brain to make a living, how did they end up working?
Well, what's an example of that person?
Looking at like a scientist, a philosopher, okay. an artist, right? And I think they're really instructive. And I think we ignore those examples because obviously we can't literally work the same way as Marie Curie or Georgia O'Keeffe mm-hmm. or, you know, Galileo. But we can learn, like, what did they discover? Because they had a lot of flexibility. What did they discover? Mm-hmm. And then we can get principles out of that and then say, now how can we adapt that to modern knowledge workers? So one of the things you discover when you study them, all sorts of seasonality, you know, intense, non-intense. I'm at Lake George for these 3 months, and that's where the real creative stuff happens, is Georgia O'Keeffe. And then back to Manhattan is where like all the work of finishing the paintings and gallery displays and networking happens. And it's these different rhythms and feelings. So Marie Curie really honing in on radium, isolating radium and getting her theory of radioactivity pulled together. She's honing in on this. She's going to win her first of 2 Nobel Prizes for this, goes away for 3 months with her family mm-hmm. to rural France. Like, it's just a different rhythm. We're the unnatural ones. We look at that and like, oh, you know, that's weird. Imagine taking those breaks. No, it's the factory model is what's unnatural. And so we just created an invisible factory for knowledge work, which is a bad way to make these intellectual Model Ts. But in a pseudo productivity regime, it's fine. Because we can do pseudo productivity all day.
Yeah.
Right. If all I have to do is show effort, I can just sit. And this is what people do, right? You do like some
Twitter
work,
open in a different tab. Different,
and you're just like on here doing that. Now it's incredibly exhausting. Like, our brain hates switching context this much. It's incredibly frustrating, but we can physically do it. And so we adopted the factory model. You can't actually do intense, hard, real knowledge work for 8 hours a day, but it's okay because we had pseudo productivity instead. And so we just sit back and we can do a lot of this sort of performance of work. So I'm arguing, no, we need to go back to a more natural pace, intense periods, less intense periods at all sorts of timescales. We need to take longer when a project comes onto our plate, not jump to the most optimistic possible timeline, but double or triple that. Mm-hmm. So I want to give myself the time to do this project well, come into it, come out of it, let it marinate a little bit. We need this more up and down, elongated pace of our work.
You know, I'm really interested in structure and why things that appear irrational actually operate that way, because it makes sense. And once again, pseudo productivity may be irrational from a productivity perspective, but if I'm a boss, think of, I'd love you to tell the Les Moonves example from the CBS in the 1990s, because once again, Les Moonves making, you'll give the example, but Les Moonves having people spend more time in seat might not have helped them get ahead of NBC. It was actually, you know,
CSI,
yeah. And of course, the reality show innovations, but it solved a problem for him because he was sort of like, okay, I'm a tied up in industry. I'm coming in.
Yes.
I'm a hard ass. They're working.
Yes.
Unless you solve for the fact that pseudo work, actually productivity, provides something helpful for the boss.
Yeah.
You have to meet them both ends. But tell the story first of what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Les Moonves story, they hire him at CBS. CBS is in third place. And he's like, okay, I got to turn around CBS. And
that's because this context, we got Seinfeld, you've got Cheers. Like, this is peak NBC.
must see TV on NBC, which is just like eating CBS's lunch. And all the CBS shows were old people aimed. Like, this was the joke back then. It was all shows aimed at, you know, people in their 60s, mm-hmm. right? You know, so they were struggling, right? They were behind on the times. So Moonves comes in, and his big innovation is, why is this parking lot half full at 3 o'clock on a Friday? right? So he's like, he sent out this memo. He's like, do you think the parking lot is half full at NBC at 3 o'clock on a Friday? I want everyone here, and you got to be here, and you got to be here early and stay here late. That's how we're going to turn it around. And they did become number one within a few years. But yeah, my argument in the book is what turned it around was this Las Vegas tram driver named Anthony Zuccher, who just got this idea about a show about criminal crime scene investigators. And it was this long, slow productivity, multi-year odyssey of him trying to develop this idea, and it's not quite working, and then it is. And it was this high cognitive octane creative output that turned around the fortunes of CBS, not the fact that the employees at Television City were there a few hours later on Friday. So it was like pseudo productivity versus the reality. But your point here is really well taken. Pseudo productivity does serve a purpose for managers, not a purpose of actually creating more value, but it does give you stability. It does give you something that's controllable. It does give you simplicity. And this is something that we shouldn't underappreciate its influence, right? So there's this book that really influenced my thinking on this. It's from the 70s, Alfred Chandler, and it was called The Visible Hand. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal. He's an economic historian, or was. I don't think he's still alive. And this was a big deal book, Pulitzer and National Book Award, right? And it was looking at the history of the growth of what he called managerial capitalism. So post-railroads, we start to get really big companies that have managers, which we take for granted now. But, you know, 19th century companies were smaller. And like, this is my company, right? Like, I'm Ebenezer Scrooge. This is my counting house.
I'm walking the floor. Like, yeah.
These are the 10 people that work for me. And like, and he was saying, okay, and he called that mercantile capitalism. There was a lot of exposure to market signals, right? So, you know, if I run my counting house more efficiently than Scrooge's, like, I could get rewarded for that from the market. And so if we have better internal processes, we could, you know, beat Scrooge and put him out of business. He said, once you get to these really large companies where it's like many, many different companies now encapsulated in one, they're much more insulated from market forces. And he says, what you see, this is Chandler talking, is in these large companies in managerial capitalism, the managers, what you begin to optimize in terms of operations internally is not what's going to be most efficient for the market, mm-hmm. or what's going to produce the most value. You begin to optimize for stability. You begin to what's going to keep things. It's not even all self-interested. It's also like, how do we, stability is good. It's bad if we're changing a lot of things internally. That could be bad. We want stability. We want simplicity. Even if this means your company is running worse, in the age of managerial capitalism, that's okay. You're insulated enough from these market forces that simplicity and stability internally can overpower the idea that, you know, if we didn't have all the pseudo productivity stuff, we could be shipping more stuff. This is what I think has happened with pseudo productivity. One of the reasons why it's sticky is it's simple and it's stable. Like, because now you can be less Moonves. You're like, I know what to do. Mm-hmm. Stay later.
Yeah.
Right. That's much more appealing than, oh my God, we got to go down to like the studs and rethink like how we manage our workloads. And this is going to be hard. We're not going to get it right at first. And we're going to, I mean, this is why in this book, unlike my last one, I aim directly at like, okay, what can individuals start doing right away? Because the challenge of trying to change CBS from the top,
yeah,
I learned from my last book, is basically intractable. Mm-hmm. It's too difficult.
Okay.
Managerial capitalism says we're not going to do it. So yeah, that's what's going on, is that there's other things that you're optimizing for if you're running one of these companies.
I think something I'm curious about then, because I think I love, we're also kind of transitioning away from the era of like big networks, but I love like that period, the book that anecdote references, Desperate Networks. It's a super good, like interesting. This is far enough of a world that's actually like fascinating to read,
yeah,
even if you're not into television. But basically, I guess what I wonder, hearing that example, I'm kind of wondering like, okay, so people are kind of out of the office at 3:30, assume they stay till like 6:30, like pushing it. What is the importance of the work you're actually doing day to day versus like a transformative 10x idea? Because the key counter examples, CSI, what, like the crime scene, like taking the police procedural,
yes,
and like adding a specifically like new bit. Like, this isn't like Hill Street Blues, like we're going one level deeper. That was a transformative idea. Rowdy TV, like those are like doing it for incredibly, so not only is it compelling and interesting, but it's also super, super cheap.
Yeah.
what do you think is the ratio of like, we're bringing in new ideas to like actually like we're working even efficiently, like even like making the process more efficiently? I'm just curious what you think about that.
I mean, I think in a lot of organizations, the ratio is terrible.
Yeah.
Right. Because so much of your time is talking about the project. Like projects still get done, but they tend to get done at a much lower level of quality, right? Because you're trying to work within these fragments of time that are left between all the talking about work, between the meetings, you know, between all the emails. But what's interesting is in some industries where the value of the idea is so valuable, right? So we're talking about like the movie industry, for example, or in big fiction writing. Mm-hmm. These industries where there's so much money riding on the idea, it could be, you know, I'm thinking Oppenheimer, like $1 billion thing, yeah, right? They do protect that.
Yeah.
Right. This is why like the director, Chris Nolan, doesn't own a phone. Like that can work because if the stakes get big enough, pseudo productivity can't last, right? So the stakes are so big, like, okay.
No one's pinging him on Slack.
Chris Nolan doesn't need a phone. Like, you know, they're like, I don't care if this makes all the rest of his representation, his lawyers, the studio, it makes all of our lives harder because, you know, we can't get a quick answer for them. He generated $1 billion with his brain. Okay. So when the stakes get really big, same thing with big time novelist, right? It's completely expected in the world of writing that novelists disappear. Don't do stuff. Show up when your book comes out, 3 weeks on the road, and that's it. And we're going to leave you alone. Because in that world, they recognize a really good novel, because this is much bigger than nonfiction, a really good novel can generate $100 million.
Yeah.
Right. So like, okay, no expectations. You know, when John Grisham's longtime personal assistant retired, he didn't bother hiring another one because he's like, no one knows, like no one talks to me. Like, I just left alone to yeah, write the book.
System's
like,
worked.
Only my editor or my agent have my number, right? Because they leave me alone. So we see it when the stakes get extreme. We can move away from pseudo productivity because transformative ideas are valuable, but we undervalue transformative ideas when it's not $1 billion at stake. And so think about how much aggregate value we're losing by not at all respecting the ability just to think clearly and have space could produce stuff that's really useful for our company. We're losing so much value doing that because we don't bother protecting that. We don't overcome the inertia of pseudo productivity until there's just so many millions of dollars on the line we can't help but to.
So before we get to the third principle, just one more question on this. To defend kind of like Steelman last movies here, especially like in the context of like Elon taking over Twitter, I wonder how much company culture matters here.
Yeah.
So yes, it's probably true that the reality TV show format and CSI didn't emerge from like last movies having people stay in for another 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
But I imagine a world where you could say to yourself, the culture at CBS was defeatist.
Yeah.
We're in third place. We're just hoping for our next big acquirer to like solve this problem for us. And we're just here to like write out the clock. I could see a world where a guy coming in and saying, no, like we're changing the culture here. We're not a place that leaves at 3:30 in the early 90s. I'm curious what you think. And this is also like Elon acquiring Twitter matters, like hardcore mode. I'm curious what you think about the role of like culture separate from the productivity aspect.
Yeah. I mean, clearly that's a common playbook. I mean, this was also Marissa Meyer when she took over Yahoo in the late 2010s, right? Mm-hmm. She came in, they were actually innovating with remote work back then. And she came in and said, no, I want people here. We're creating a culture here where we work really hard. Yahoo still failed.
Yeah.
Right. Because what matters, like what helped the culture at CBS was being number one because your shows were awesome. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
so it's the metric. You have to. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, culture really matters, but you can't shape the culture just by turning the pseudo productivity knobs. Like you shape the culture by your company's doing something people get excited about. So, you know, probably CSI hitting and then Survivor hitting right around the same time probably did more for the CBS culture than Moonves railing. Right. I mean, that being said, like culture is important and you want people to take it seriously. And large organizations have ossification. So there's something there. But what's really going to turn these places around is we're number one in the ratings. Right. And it's a little chicken and egg, chicken and egg. But actually here, I think we can solve the riddle. The thing that came first is going to actually be the hit ideas, the great ideas.
I love that answer so much because you're even in the way I was asking the question, there was still like pseudo productivity like metrics there, because the actual metric that turned around CBS was accepting good ideas, generating good ideas. As you point out in the book, CSI was a gamble. It was a gamble. So from a cultural perspective, I would want to say to ourselves, look, we're in third place. we can't just keep putting out like the safe, easy choice. I want you as an executive to feel comfortable that if you take a gamble on something that could be a home run, I'm not going to punish you if an alternative doesn't work. Like that is a cultural value matters, not like our value. And also like, let's say you're at an IT company and like customer complaints actually aren't being responded to because no one's at their desk. That's an example where it's not, but the point is it's not pseudo. Like there's an actual direct translation between responding to like your call log in your desk in the situation. So it's so helpful to reframe in that sense.
Yeah. Like there's a process-based culture is really important. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You come in and say, you know, it's like Steve Jobs returning to Apple in the 90s. Like, okay, this isn't working. We need to simplify this. We need to change where the engineers are working, but it's not pseudo productivity. That's straight up process culture. No one's here to answer these IT calls. All right. We need to come in and rethink about our customer support process. So that, like we're doing what we need to do. But like Les Moonves's best decision was probably the faith he put into the executive. I think her name was Nita Totenberg, but I might be mixing her name up with an NPR reporter.
Her first name was Nina.
Nina, right? You know the name I'm talking about. Nina Totenberg's at NPR, but there was an executive who championed CSI. Mm-hmm. She's the one who took the risk, right? So like probably it was like Moonves recognizing that Nina, last name redacted, had a great instinct and empowering her to convince him. And they added CSI at the final slot, the final slot of the season.
So let's get to the third principle.
Yeah. Obsess over quality. Yeah. This is the glue for the other two.
And the quick funny thing is that this is also the one which peak everyone could say this is what we're doing, but you're actually not doing this.
Yeah.
Like there's not a single manager who's like, oh, no, of course all of my employees are obsessing over quality. This is where the gap between what you say in your head and what you're doing is going
to
be greatest.
Yeah. This is where people like to talk about it, but people aren't actually doing. It is the glue, right? So obsessing over quality means you figure out in your job what really matters. All right. And which of these things am I going to own? And then how do I systematically get better at this? Like, I really want to care about doing this thing better. Mm-hmm. And I want to keep getting better at it. That mindset's what makes the whole thing sustainable, right? So if you don't have that mindset, first of all, just from a psychological perspective, if you're just reducing what you're working on and trying to work at more of a natural pace, this could lead to a sort of antagonistic relationship with work, right? Because I'm just trying to reduce it and I'm trying to slow down the time, and you could end up in more of an anti-productivity space where, psychologically speaking, this is pure just antagonism, trying to reduce this footprint on my life. When you're obsessing over quality, what happens is that drive to want to simplify, to do fewer things, to work at a more natural pace becomes really natural. Right. When you obsess over quality, you're like, oh, I need to do that because it's getting in the way of me doing this really well, which is a different way to come to slowness than just from the standpoint of fastness feels bad.
OK.
Right. So that's important. So simplifying and slowing down becomes completely natural just because busyness is anathema to producing quality. Then this is the flip side of it. As you get better because you're obsessing over quality, you gain more leverage and control to be more radical in those changes. Mm-hmm. Now I have more control. I've gained more say in my job. I'm really good at what I do. And I can start making demands about how and when I want to work that I couldn't do before, right? Because I'm very valuable now to the employer. Mm-hmm. So it makes you dislike busyness and then gives you the tools over time to be increasingly drastic about how you reduce busyness. So that's like the engine in some sense to the whole slow productivity project.
So here's the big question that ties us all together. I'm wondering, you started working on this book in 2021, so this is during like COVID, especially DC was particularly locked down during that 2021 period. So like this is like really relevant. There was the Overton window about like work and our standards is probably the widest it's ever going to be in our lifetimes. I'm curious where you assess everything ended up.
Yeah.
I bought a couple pairs of like dress sweatpants that did not age well. That was a bad call from Bonobos. I should not have done that. That's an example because that was when they were trying to like, you're always going to work from home. So we'll make the work from home clothes comfortable, but still like kind of formal. They're kind of like dress pants. Terrible call. Shouldn't have bought those. But from your perspective, where did you see everything end up?
Yeah. So I covered this closely like during that period. So during that 2021 in particular, I was writing a twice a month column for The New Yorker that was just looking at the impact of the pandemic on knowledge work. Like, so I was really talking to a lot of people, covering this from a lot of angles. What I think happened, like my take on all of this is, okay, so we get this disruptions of the pandemic, opens the Overton window, and people are excited to jump into this broader window because this burnout issue had been simmering and the pandemic even made it worse, right? So like, we're ready for a change. And now we're ready to change in a way that we weren't before because, hey, look, they told us for 15 years that like work from home would never work, yeah. right? I documented this in an early article in the pandemic. All of the technology was in place for remote work roughly 2006. That was the point in which this was possible. And a lot of people experimented with it. And a lot of bosses said, I don't like this.
That's the Yahoo example.
That's the Yahoo example. And so it just went away. Like, this will never work. And here's the 10 problems. And then they said, wait a second. In like 3 days, this entire sector went remote and like it didn't all fall apart. So what else were we getting wrong? So it gave us like a mindset of reform. I think we largely missed opportunity for meaningful change in that period.
Who's we?
Knowledge work in general.
Okay.
So knowledge workers in general, like things got to change. But we didn't have great, this is part of what motivated me in this project, to be super articulate about this is the problem.
Okay.
Here is pseudo productivity here, because we didn't have that vocabulary. So people were fed up, but they didn't have a sort of knowledge work equivalent of, you know, Marie Antoinette to point to and said, this is what we're revolting against. So they fixated on what was obvious. And the only thing, the main thing that was obvious in remote work was remote work. And so a lot of this energy went into like the hybrid work, remote work wars, which caught a lot of managers off guard. Because the managers were like, okay, we've been in person forever.
Yeah.
And we temporarily had to go remote because of a public health thing. I mean, clearly the default thing to do is we're going to go back to being in person. And there was this huge backlash of like, how could you even consider that? And they're like, what do you mean? This is what we were doing like a minute ago. I think a lot of this was just misplaced reform zeal. And it was the only thing on the menu that people could think of. And so a lot of this energy went into that. A lot of this energy went into the Great Resignation, right? Those who were in a position to essentially quit did. I'm done with this. I'm going to go move to the cabin. We got quiet quitting for the younger people who couldn't quit. Right. Yeah. And so they're like, well, then I'm going to like stop participating and basically do the bare minimum. All of this, like my argument is that all of this was us lashing out because of this fundamental issue of the pseudo productivity burnout crisis. And none of those solutions got to the actual issue. Mm-hmm. Like that's why they came and they went. In a piece I wrote summarizing this a couple months ago, I talked about it as like waves of reform zeal crashing against the shores of reality and then sort of dissipating away, right? And the main thing that came out of this is we ended up with a consensus around hybrid work.
Yeah.
Okay, 2 days a week you could be from home. That's by far now the most common configuration of remote capable knowledge work jobs in 2024 is hybrid work. There's 2x more people doing that than fully remote work, for example. So I think we knew things needed to change. We felt like it was time to change. We could change something now.
Yeah.
And like nothing meaningful came out of it except for like we can now work 2 days at home.
And the biggest problem, badly done hybrid or remote work fuels pseudo productivity.
Yeah.
Because in that case, it's like, I'm a manager. I literally have to know what people are doing. Okay, who's light is green on Slack? How fast is your email response time? I need to prove that you're not just like at the gym at like 2 o'clock. So I'm actually going to track how long your email response times are actually done. I may have been caught on the wrong end of this a couple of times.
You email between sets, man. That's the thing. That's the thing. But look, so I wrote an article just a couple of days before we're talking for The Atlantic where I talked about exactly this was hybrid work. And I said, here's my proposal. And I'm still curious to see if anyone follows up on this. I was like, if we really wanted to make a change, the hybrid work is a good first step because that's a real big disruption. Here's the second piece you need for that. All right. We synchronize the hybrid schedule. During the at-home days, there's no meetings. There's no email. During the in-office days, we could have meetings and email. I said, add that on. You're going to see a huge change to pseudo productivity and overload.
I also like that because you are getting at the... You need articulations of in-person that aren't arbitrary.
Yes.
It is arbitrary. And this is actually why, and it feels as if employers eventually won. The economy helped employers win the fight over going back in person. But at their worst, they were just saying like, well, we have to be in.
Yeah.
It's like, why? Because they couldn't use this doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
There's no technological reason
why
this couldn't be done. So they were just left this like arbitrary, well, you have to be in because you have to be in. If you're just saying no, because like we don't do terrible Zoom cursed meetings during your 2 days. So the reason why is that like in, so I think that's just really helpful because actually, once again, it gives something to someone use. There's something useful from both ends.
Yes.
Because that's what actually gets that done for people.
I mean, I think if you're the first major company to say this is what we do, There'll be 2 days a week where there's no Zoom and no email, no Slack.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, you can't talk about, you just work.
Yeah.
And then the other days you can have meetings and work as well, but you have meetings with this or that. I think
and we know, but you're going to take like, you know, an hour and a half for that lunch and you're maybe on Twitter.
We're going to trust you with that. Yeah. You're going to have applications out the door.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then this helps with pseudo productivity. So this is like a really crude way to solve some of these problems, right? Without having, you know, I have much more sophisticated strategies, but it's going to help the workload issue for sure. Because what's going to happen? Well, on those days where there's no meetings, there's no email, you can actually get things done. So you can clear out your, you know, stay on your queue of work better. There are also days where people aren't giving you new work, right? Because the main limiter we have on the rate at which I push work on your plate is basically social,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, especially if I'm giving it to you in person.
Yeah.
Which makes a big difference. It's an interesting thing people don't realize. It's much easier to give people work digitally than in person, because in person, I have to see you.
Yeah.
I'm now, this is a whole different
interaction.
Hey, I
know that we had that thing last week, but actually.
And I'm like, I'm asking you to do a favor for me. Like, all of our evolutionary wiring fires in place, and there's a lot of social friction. And there's like some interesting examples of this where you just take the exact same situation and you change it from emailing work requests to walking down the hall, and it makes a drastic difference in how much work people pass on, right? So there's a limit to how much work I'm going to give you in a given day, right? So it's not as if, well, what I'm going to do is on the non-remote days give you twice as much work. No, it's going to blow past like the socially acceptable limit. So there's just less, a lower rate of work coming your direction and more time to actually execute work. The overload problem is going to be significantly reduced.
So let's close here, just like some quick rapid fires on other topics you're interested in. So number one, obviously you're famous for, before it was cool, being anti-social media from a participation perspective. What is your policy towards the Apple Vision Pro and spatial computing? Because like, the generic take of on the doomer side is like, oh man, this is alienating. This is going to be this, that. I'm curious what your thought on it is.
Yeah, I don't worry about being alienating. What the economic disruption at play here, I think, is much larger than people think. I think a lot of people haven't realized what's actually going on here. The Apple Vision Pro is Apple trying to get ahead of an existential threat to their entire business. So the whole idea, this is my take on this, but the whole idea here is to get rid of screens as we know it, right? So right, they're using this whole experiment. This is an experimental product, right? They're using pass-through cameras, these big things. But once you get the form factor of this thing down to a pair of Ray-Ban sunglasses and it's optical waveguide and not pass-through cameras, right? I don't need to own any other screens.
Yeah.
I don't need to own a phone. I don't need to own an iPad. I don't need to own a laptop. I don't need to own a TV. Right? Because I can make a screen wherever I need a screen. It'll be high resolution and big. In fact, I wrote about this during the pandemic. The number one productivity app in the Oculus store during the pandemic was not social VR, right? Like, oh, we could have meetings in VR. We can whatever. It was a company called Immersed, and their whole product was we take the screens on your laptop or whatever, and we give virtual screens and virtual reality. And why was it the number one productivity app?
That's a cool app. Yeah.
Programmers at home could have three giant monitors to work on in VR. This is the big play. So Apple realizes if we lose on this play and someone else gets here, like Meta gets here first or something like this, no one's going to buy another Apple product again. Like the whole thing we do at Apple is we make really nice glass and metal, buffed metal cases that we sell to you at huge profit, right? That we make really good software, but that's not a $1 trillion-a-year business.
The moat is their hardware.
I want this like beautiful looking titanium, you know, phone or whatever. AR is going to make that all go away, right? Like, why am I going to buy all these different screens if I can make a screen for anything I need, from movie size down to phone size, anywhere that's going to be? So this is, I think, a like multi-trillion-dollar economic play that's happening. And Apple's innovation versus Google is that, you know, Google was in on this early with their Magic Leap investment.
Yeah.
But Magic Leap they jumped straight ahead to the technology of waveguides. So I'm seeing the real world through a piece of plastic, and the virtual world is being kind of projected into the plastic and being added into what I'm seeing. This is a really difficult technology to get right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're being held up because that's really hard to do. And it's a very small field of vision. Apple said, let's focus on the app side. So we'll just have a camera filming the world around you.
Yeah.
So now we're adding virtual elements to a video stream. not like literally into the path of photons coming in from the real world. That's 10x easier to deal with. So they can focus on, let's figure out how we actually move screens into this world and make this a useful experience. And then the waveguide, their bet is that we'll figure out later, like the tech's not quite there yet. So let's not waste time on that yet. Let's work on the software side of this problem. So I think it's one of the most important things. I think it's as important, if not more important than AI right now, which people think I'm crazy about it.
Fascinating.
But I think more money is at stake with this right now than there is, let's say, with Gen AI. It's existential for the largest company in the world.
So relating to AI, obviously, you're a computer theorist. You think a lot about these spaces. I saw the CEO of NVIDIA gave a talk where he said that folks like shouldn't even bother learning to code. Not like in the literal sense, but like in the terms of like our response to the 21st century has been like, okay, STEM, learn to code, have the specific thing. Like he's so bullish on AI that he thinks that in many ways that opportunity is going to go away for folks. I'm curious, less about the veracity of the prediction about coding just being purely written prompts and everything, yeah, versus, but more just this idea that we've had this answer to our future, code, generically code, do that.
Yeah.
What it means if we lose that generic easy answer, like all this, you know, states that are like defunding their liberal arts departments because everyone's going to be a coder and in STEM, that is like the category would be the most bearish if even there's something directionally accurate to what he's describing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. I mean, I think where we're probably going to see the biggest impact is more on the low end of coding, the sort of 6-week boot camp so I can do JavaScript or something like this. The goal here is not to have a machine just from beginning to end producing programs. The goal here is much more of a sort of cyborg type approach. Working with the machine, I'm going to be able to produce code much faster. This is bad for the bootcamp industry because actually I can just learn how to do this pretty quickly. But I think it's going to be more of a productivity play.
Okay.
Right. So that coders, and this has been the whole history of computer programming, right? Like one of the largest leaps in productivity in the last 20 years in computer programming was the rise of the modern IDE with autocomplete. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is, okay, I can just start typing. I mean, I don't want to get too much in the coding weeds, but you have to memorize a lot of or look up a lot of function names, library calls, because you have to very carefully, you have to say it exactly right and know exactly like what parameter. So we got these more modern integrated development environments, the environments where people code, and they would autocomplete. Like, oh, here's the name of the things I think you're trying to code here, and here's exactly. And that saved, you know, 40%. Of time because I'm not looking these things up every time. It's like these things made a big difference. They didn't make the coding industry go away, but they made a big difference. So I think we're going to see increasing symbiosis between coders and these tools. But I also say we've had these major productivity boost in coding as well. Like another major boost was Google and the internet. Like if you're a computer scientist, you know this, the average person doesn't. A huge part of the workflow of producing code now is like Googling examples, going to Stack Overflow, show me this. And Google is like a productivity miracle for coders because now, even if you're not super familiar with a language, you can very quickly just find examples of code. A couple of years ago, I was making a lot of video games for my kids and I'm a theoretician, so I had to dust off my my programming skills. And I was using a game package for Python and I didn't read a book. I didn't read a tutorial. I just could Google as I went, like, okay, what are the color classes? What are the whatever? And so we've had these massive productivity boosts to coding in the past, and they've been very important for the coders. They made their lives much easier. None of them actually led to a discernible decrease in the number of people coding. So it'll be very interesting to see these continued productivity boosting plays. Mm-hmm. How is that going to impact coding? Is it going to wipe out whole sectors of like JavaScript coders? Maybe. Is it going to lead to much better code? Maybe. I mean, I don't know. So I think there's a lot of very radical claims being made. And right now it's like too early to tell on most of these.
So last two topics. One, you were notorious for being anti-social media before it was cool. Like I said, very controversial piece. You now have states that are trying to pass social media bans. I'm curious just what you think, separate from your need to evaluate the legislation because specifics are complicated. This. What is your take on the like unironic vibe shift that's happened over the past 8 years?
Yeah, I mean, look, I lived this, right? I lived this vibe shift because when I came out as anti-social media, I was considered eccentric. at best.
Right? And this was before the 2016 election, correct?
Before the 2016.
So, yeah, so this like real, yeah.
And like it actually generated like a lot of issues, right? So, and I wrote about this recently, but I had an op-ed like right after the 2016 election, actually, right? It was the week after, right? It was the same week as the like Mark Dalilla piece about like with Trump got elected and the once in future Democrats and all this type of things, once in future liberal, whatever his take was, like all this stuff was happening. I had a piece that had an op-ed in the Times that had quit social media in the title.
Yeah.
It says late as the fall of 2016. And it was like hell broke loose. It was like a matrix, the glitch in the matrix, a narrative violation. I had jumped outside of the Overton window for mainstream discussion of social media, and I was getting attacked. I was being like ambushed in radio shows. The New York Times 2 weeks later published a response op-ed that went through my op-ed and said, this point's wrong. This point, like it was like a narrative violation.
Yeah.
Right. Same thing that the TEDx talk I gave on quitting social media, which is like this viral thing, 10 million views. When I gave that talk and I told them this talk, it's about quitting social media. The title is Quit Social Media. The organizers of TEDx were so uncomfortable about that, that they changed the title to something like How to Work Deeply in a Distracted World. And I went back to them and said, no. This is deliberately provocative. Quit social media. That's what this actually talked about. By 2017, it was like, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it was the 2016 election for various reasons, completely shifted the vibes on it. And now we're like completely comfortable with, you know, it is not at all interesting about me that I don't use social media.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a way that it was.
This would have led the podcast if we did this 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So you're this wackadoo. No, but it's a given.
It's a given. Now, like a lot of people don't. Right. Yeah. Because people. So. So it's interesting to go through that vibe shift. The big play now, I think, is trying to understand kids. Mm. That's the big discussion now. Kids and social media. And, you know, one of my arguments is I have this philosophy. I describe my philosophy of technology as techno-selectionism is like what I call it, which is it's difficult. Techno-human cultural systems are dynamical. So it's hard to predict in advance, like what this thing is going to do. You bring email to the office to replace a fax machine, and 4 years later, you're sending 150 email messages a day. Steve Jobs in 2007 is introducing the iPhones. Like you don't have to carry your Razr and your iPod. They're combined. You know, he's not predicting 10 years later, you're going to have a teen mental health crisis. Like it's hard to predict these things, right? So techno-selectionism is like you have to be really aware of what's happening with technology, how it's affecting you, how it's affecting the culture, and be willing to make retrospective decisions and say, okay, we introduced this, we're using it, it's having a big negative impact. Let's stop doing this, right? We should be super selective even after the fact when technology is introduced. So I think the big techno-selectionism question right now is, was a mistake to allow teenagers or below you social media? Mm-hmm. And I do not think we should say it's too late to go back on that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't know how else we can navigate these technologies and their impact and their scale without a willingness to notice we thought this would be okay. We don't like what it's doing now. Let's change our cultural response to it. And so I think this is the big debate now is do we go back and say, actually, unrestricted internet access for like prepubescent kids, that's a bad idea. We did it and we saw it was bad. Let's stop doing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like the number one sort of tech culture question in my mind that's going on right now.
Last but not least, that relates to the podcast at a meta level, the creator economy. We went through a really interesting period where not only everyone was writing and talking about this, but all these companies were funded. All these people went independent, but now publications are shutting down and a bunch of people who went independent are now like burnt out. Like there's so many different things you could pick. I'd love for you just like summary of where you're at as someone who wrote about the phenomenon.
Yeah, no, I think we're doing better than we were. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, right, we get the internet comes along. We get Kevin Kelly, 1,000 true fans.
Yeah.
Right? So this is like the manifesto for this idea of like a middle-class creator economy, right? That because the internet is a universal set of protocols, you can reach anybody. Mm-hmm. So now if you can find 1,000 true fans to, you know, support you at $100, right? You can make $100,000. Like that was his math. And you know, when he wrote this, social media, I think sidetracked us from that dream for a long time, right?
The scale. Because think of it this way, if it's 2015.
Yeah.
If I said, I've got 1,000 people who listen to my podcast, you'd be like, okay, I posted this video on Facebook and way more people saw that. It'd be embarrassing.
20 million people saw this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what social media did is they said, okay, here's our bargain for you, the creators, right? you're going to create for free for us, right? So you're going to create for us, and then we're going to put your stuff into this big collection that algorithms will sort through to try to engage people's attention. We're not going to pay you for this. Mm-hmm. But we will have this sort of collective attention economy, right? Like, you're going to get views, and like, people are going to comment on things, and you're going to feel like people are paying attention to you.
Sell some products, you know?
Yeah, but this was like a really, we forget this, but this was actually a compelling proposition in the early Web 2 days, right? So the early Web 2 days come along, we get blogs, right? Now, anyone can not just consume information on the internet, but produce their own information. And the problem with early Web 2 is everyone created a blog, and most people had no interest in reading most people's blogs. And it was like really depressing, because you would, here's my thoughts, like Marshall's musings, right? And like, no one would read it, because it's very hard to actually produce stuff that people care about. And so people were like, ah, this whole Web 2 thing is a failure because no one's reading my blog. And look at all these stupid blogs, right? That was the whole joke. And then Facebook comes along, and what they were really pitching back then was attention, right? And they're pitching to investors, we're going to get you eyeballs, but they were pitching to users. Unlike your GeoCities blog, that's kind of embarrassing and no one reads. Go on Facebook. We have this pact that people, your friends will comment on your things. You'll comment on your friends' things. Occasionally things will go viral. Other people comment on them. We can give you attention. And you can feel like, okay, people are paying it, without actually having to earn that in the marketplace of just pay attention to the thing I'm writing, which is very hard to do. And that was incredibly seductive. And so those companies were very powerful. But for talented creators, it's a bad deal, because they're not paying them money. There's no 1,000 true fans.
Yeah.
Like, all you're getting is attention and vibes and clout and trying to feel good. As the social media age is beginning to wane, my argument is like, we're now back in a much better situation. Podcasts are a great example. They're independent. Right? You have a podcast, it's on a server somewhere. The server has an RSS feed. Anyone with any player can subscribe to that and listen to any podcast. It's not owned by someone else. And the economics are good, right? If you have a successful podcast, CPMs are very high. Mm. Like, you can make a living off of it. I have a podcast I've worked on for a while. I now earn more from my podcast than I do as a professor.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, not like a lot more, but it's like a really good, like, knowledge work, you know, like middle class, upper middle class job.
Yeah.
Right. So podcasting is better. Substacking found out how it's possible to have reasonable economics for writing in a way that blogging didn't. Like, oh, if it's subscription based, I can get, now suddenly my 1,000 true fans is something that I can maybe make a living on, or I could support. So I think all of this is positive. Now, again, the reality of it is, you have to remember the original Web 2 days, most people aren't going to make any money still. Yeah. But that was never the promise of democratizing the means of reaching people. We never promised to democratize the audience reach, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still really hard to get someone to subscribe to a Substack or to listen to a podcast, right? But many more people can do this now, right? So I'm much more bullish that we're getting back towards an internet-fueled middle-class creative economy in a way that we lost like 5 years on because we were blinded by Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
So I guess for my personal question to close it out then is, how, I actually don't, so I don't really tweet. I basically have taken I operationally follow your procedure. I lurk on Instagram. Actually, I have the least productive version of your ideas, in that like, I don't produce
you
any
get
content,
no benefit,
but I just lurk and like consume and destroy my screen time. But once again, the good thing social media does provide is distribution, getting things out there. How do you think about distributing this work if you're not building on these platforms? Because it's so hard just by audio shout outs. Say, hey, like, guys, I'm being serious here. Yeah. Send this to 5 of your friends. You can pull it out like twice, 2 or 3 times a year. You can't like generically spam that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple things going on. I mean, I think the border between things like podcast and some of these other platforms is much more secure than people realize, right? Like, for example, we put our podcast on YouTube, because I think video is the future. I don't think YouTube is the future. I hate algorithmic curation. We were talking about this, but I do think video is going to be the future for independent media. And we need the practice. My YouTube guy tells me this is a different audience. Mm-hmm. It's not going to drive people to your audio podcast.
These are totally different people.
Yes. And if you want to try to monetize a YouTube audience, like, that's a whole other thing, because you have to have a much bigger audience in YouTube to try to monetize. It's much lower CPM rates. And so to get that much bigger audience, you have to do YouTube things, which is probably going to be very different than what's making your podcast popular. So we just have this sort of firewall up. It's like, yeah, you could post these on YouTube. What I'm caring about is my download numbers on the audio. Right. So similar things are true for Instagram and Twitter. It's not driving. You can get a lot of views on there, but it's in a slipstream of algorithmically curated straight to the brainstem entertainment for people. It doesn't lead to a lot of, okay, now I want to subscribe to this. It does some, but not to a lot. So, I mean, I think it's possible. Where I've seen people have been successful is there's certainly podcasts, for example, where they say, yeah, we have a social media strategy.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, we post, and it's this guy does it. And yeah. It's like clips and it's, you know, quotes and it's whatever. And it's done, you know, very regularly. But I don't touch it. Yeah. And I don't read it. And I'm not responding to people. And I think like that's like a perfectly reasonable play. Does this help? Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been doing this podcast tour recently and I love talking to the production teams. That's the thing that's interesting to me. And they often have like these bigger shows, like here's their social media person.
Yeah.
But these hosts don't touch this stuff.
Yeah.
Right. It's clips on this schedule. So we'll see. Like I was just on the Minimalist show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know them.
Yeah.
And I convinced them to run an experiment where they're going to shut down all of their social media promotion till the end of the year and just see what happens.
Yeah.
They're curious. Like, will this really change our numbers? And if it does change our numbers, though, was it worth it? Like, you know, so they're experimenting with this. So, you know, I think I don't like the narrative that it's somehow inevitable that you have to be using these platforms to grow independent.
Because people are also pushing this with the like, see, YouTube is now optimized for podcasts and podcasting is to turn into video. I want to be clear to the audience. When you are saying, I don't think YouTube is the future, you're saying that generically, but you're also saying that in the know, in the podcasting industry, there's this very, I think, quasi inorganic campaign to push everyone to becoming a video person first. Everyone knows the podcast on the side. And you're very specifically speaking out against that.
No, I think it's the wrong play. I mean, YouTube wants this to happen because they see the numbers, right?
Yeah.
And this is just more content. And it's also the content YouTube loves, right? I mean, one of the things I realized on this tour was different than a lot of past tours. My last tour was 2019 because of the pandemic. And I was like, why am I getting more exhausted on these days? It's because everything's 2.5 hours long. And it used to be 60 minutes long. That's a YouTube effect partially because YouTube, it's their gold is someone watching a video for 2.5 hours is like their number one thing. This is why this is like a new thing. So YouTube loves it. They want all this podcasting stuff happening, you know, on YouTube. But from the podcasters, you got to be careful.
Yeah.
Right. Because what you need to do as a podcaster is make a great podcast. And podcasts grow pretty slowly, right? I mean, there's a couple like Andrew Huberman's out there, but they grow pretty slowly because it is pretty word of mouth. I'm used to this though, because I'm a book writer.
Yeah.
Right. And I have a bunch of books that have done really well that took a really long time to do really well. Like I'm very familiar, you know, like Deep Work has never been on a bestseller list. Never. It sold almost 2 million copies. Never been on a bestseller list. And the first 6 months it came out, disappointing sales. Like I'm used to.
That's fascinating.
Create something that I think is great. And then keep talking about it. And hopefully over time it catches on and starts to sell. So I'm used to that. I'm ready to play the long game. So, you know, I think video is the future, but the YouTube algorithm is not. So it's like, you have to embrace, if you're a podcaster, you probably do have to embrace video at some point, because I think it's going to be the future. But be careful that in doing that, you don't let the YouTube algorithm take a role as one of your producers. Because your show is going to get weird, right? Like you're going to start having some pretty hot takes or some stunts. Like we were talking about beforehand, if I went off of YouTube views, my show would be all like hardcore productivity advice. Yeah. Stop using your phone and gain back like 10 hours of your day, heavily edited videos. Like I could kill it in terms of like YouTube subscriber numbers, but to what end?
Yeah. So I think staying rooted is key. Well, this has been really great, Cal. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Marshall. Enjoyed it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.